irrational to have an international court set up this body without having the mechanism to enforce what it rules?
Well, I differ to some extent with my colleague Daniel, with whom I agree on almost everything else. I think there is a way to enforce the ruling and to enforce, more importantly, the will, the international will. Yemen is doing it. They are reducing the flow of naval traffic through the Red Sea. Now, it's true that it's being diverted by land across the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan, and it's getting into Israel, but not as easily, not as well, and at greater cost. In addition, some countries, and it was either this morning or yesterday, that Canada passed a bill in Parliament saying that it is not going to supply any more arms to Israel, period. And other measures were included in that. I don't have it at my fingertips, but countries can do that. And even the Netherlands has also said it will not ship spare parts. There are other ways that that countries can intervene. For example, they can, I know that airlifts have and airdrops have a bad name because of the control of Israel over these airdrops. But suppose the countries of the world, or a serious number of major countries in the world, let's say a dozen of them, decide to send without Israeli controls massive amounts of airdrops and aid into the Gaza Strip without flying through Israeli territory, only Gaza territory, and to drop aid, defying the will of the Israeli military and the airspace, and basically to take over the airspace of Gaza. These are things which are possible. Would Israel, let's say, shoot down the aircraft of nations like Spain and Norway and Belgium? Would they do that? I don't think so. I think that there are ways, and little by little, countries of the world are coming to adopt some of these ways. The United States is an obstacle, but I think even the United States will have to take some measures pretty soon. President Biden will most likely lose if he runs in the fall election. He may resign before then or decide not to run. But there are ways that the countries of the world, if they have the will to do it, they can do it with or without the United States.
You're absolutely right. And we also have the international public opinion completely shifting against Israel. We are seeing demonstrations in countries that are known to be allies of the Israeli regime. And interestingly, we see that the people in those countries are now shifting against Israel, which shows that public opinion now today is more aware of what is happening on the ground, and it is not taken by the propaganda of mainstream media in support of the Israeli regime. So back to our guest in Beirut. Do you think that public opinion can actually bring about some kind of a change?
Yeah, I think it remains to be seen in the long run to what extent the shift in public opinion or the very visible demonstrations that we see, including in Western capitals, will have an impact. But for sure, we can see that to some extent it might exert pressure on elected officials. And it might also increase the very clear discrepancy between the regimes that are, most of which, in particular in the West, are tied to the Israeli regime, and the gap between them and the people. But we've also seen, especially in places such as Germany, an increase in censorship, an increase in coercion of public dissent, of protests, and a boycott of protesters by the state. So this has led in some places to even more measures that limit freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and the freedom in particular when it comes to Palestine. But I do think that it's become at least much more obvious that there is a global support for human rights, and that the Palestinian cause and what is actually taking place in Palestine has become impossible to ignore at this point.
Exactly. And Mr. Larudi, this would be our last question. So in your opinion, we're also seeing a political fallout within the Zionist entity itself, with some members saying that you are going too extreme and we are losing our allies. What do you think the future holds for the Zionist entity, considering the situation?
The Zionist entity is finished. It has lost this war. It has lost the support of the international community, and it has lost the support of even the Jewish youth in the United States, which is the largest Jewish population outside Israel. In fact, I think it's even slightly larger than Israel. I think Israel... Now, it's my understanding that roughly a million Israeli Jews have left since October 7th. That's a major proportion of their population. Unfortunately, what's left in Israel is a very militant and, you can say, terrorist population. And they are extremely racist, extremely... How shall I say, bloodthirsty? It's not limited to the officials of the government. There's a large proportion of the population that supports the genocide. I think that this is going to be difficult for them to overcome. If I had to call a winner in the war, it seems to me that it's going to the side of Hamas, despite the genocide that Israel is perpetrating on the Palestinians. So, but in the meantime, we have to try to do something to stop the genocide and to spare the people of Gaza.
Exactly, we need to get that to stop. Thank you very much. We're running out of time. Mr. Daniel Yegich, author and researcher, joining us from Beirut, and Mr. Paul Larudi, co-founder of the Free Palestine Movement from Berkeley. Thank you very much for joining us.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arab English Radio. Thank you very much for joining us in today's episode of Muslim Lady. Well, this is Asma, your host. Once more, I have the pleasure to be in this studio. And here with me, I have Sister Rehana. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Assalamu alaikum to our dear listeners. I'm very happy to be here. And of course, Ramadan Kareem to all of my
yes, of course.
Muslim
Thank
friends
you for
all over the world.
Up. So that's very amazing. Ramadan Kareem to you and to everyone who's listening to us, and especially to the Muslim ladies. I think when the holy month of Ramadan comes, all the mothers and all the Muslim ladies are going to go through too much. Whatever they do is going to be doubled up. So before we get into our discussion, I just want you to introduce yourself very much briefly for those who still are not familiar with you.
I'm Rehana Paisapal, and I'm an Islamic researcher, especially on women's issues in today's age. And I am also a mother.
Ah, that's very amazing. In today's episode, we're going to talk about something which is unfortunately something that has been common. Nowadays, in today's world, we see that the first problem that gets in the life of couples, the first solution that they get to meet is divorce. And divorce is not an easy thing in a religion. Like, you have to give it a second thought, a third thought, and not very quickly get into it. I'm sure there are a lot of alternatives to and a lot of solutions in order for divorce to get away, like to for this choice to fade away and not to be considered as a choice, which is, I guess, about the relationship between the couples, like how they could moderate the situation so that they would not get into divorce from an Islamic perspective, of course.
In Islam, divorce is one of the things that is permissible, but has been very much condemned.
Yeah.
So it is not to be taken lightly at all whatsoever. However, in today's society, we see that it has become more common for couples to resort to this way whenever they get into a dispute or they feel they've reached a dead end, so to speak.
But religiously speaking, it's the last solution. Like, you have tried all the situations, all the solutions, all the ways to get out of this entanglement, and then the last choice is divorce.
Exactly. And there is a narration from Imam Ali, peace be upon him, that says, "Among that which Allah has made permissible, there is nothing he hates more than divorce. And Allah hates a man who divorces and marries many women." So it is permissible as a last resort. However, it must not be taken lightly at all.
Exactly. In order to get a clear slate in here, let's just talk about the reasons and the ways that are going to lead to divorce. Like, what happens in a family? Because, you know, this institution, family institution, is not an easy thing to be broken, to be destroyed. So what happens to a married life in which they get to this decision that, okay, divorce is the best way?
Well, there are some reasons that we will mention, of course. But it is important to note that for all of these reasons that we're going to mention, we're going to talk about the ways that Islam has
suggested.
Yeah, the ways that Islam has suggested to, first of all, prevent these problems from occurring in the first place, because, of course, prevention is the best remedy. And secondly, to resolve these situations, resolve any disputes if they occur. Because, well, it's very possible, of course, for a married couple to have disputes at one point or another in their life.
Yeah, that's very common. Yes. I mean, like, siblings even get into a dispute. They would even hate each other for a temporary time. But the thing is that they would not get to cut each other from their existence.
Yes, exactly. It happens to everyone, of course. In any relationship, you might have a falling out for a short period. And the important thing to remember is to not give up. One of the reasons that people mention when they give reasons for divorce is when they lose attraction for each other. So it can happen.
Which is very normal, I guess.
Yes,
like after a certain time, after a certain span of time, we're going to get used to each other. First, when a relationship is going to start, when a life is going to be built, you have some attraction for each other, like this is a new world, I'm a new world. So it's like you're going to discover another universe. So for sure, after a short time, you will come to this point that, okay, he or she is just somebody like me. We are so ordinary people, like we have our flaws, we can err sometimes, we're prone to err, and we're not all beautiful. It's not all about the good features that I have. Sometimes I might turn into a monster. So these things are very, real.
Yes, but I would like to separate it into two different parts.
Mm-hmm.
The first part is, the passion and the honeymoon phase, so to speak.
Oh, yeah.
That just ends after a short while. So this is one side of it. The honeymoon phase ends eventually. And it happens in every relationship.
The title says it all.
Yes, so it ends. And I believe the reason that, perhaps mostly in the world of celebrities, the reason that we see their marriages ending so quickly after 2 years or 1 year.
In a blink of an eye.
Yeah, I think that is the main reason for their divorces. So,
like the honeymoon phase ends.
Exactly. So that first period where there is lots of passion, that just ends eventually, obviously. It can't last forever.
Still, we are in the introductory phase, and we went to the point that, okay, one of the factors that will lead to divorce is the fact that maybe the honeymoon phase is ending and we're meeting the reality, we're facing the reality, and sometimes this reality is not as beautiful as we have imagined that in our mind.
Well, we said that there must be a distinction when people say that the reason for their divorce is loss of attraction, or we just, some celebrities say we lost our spark. We must make the distinction between, firstly, the honeymoon phase ending. And for that, I believe the solution that Islam gives is to get married with an open eye and to decide not just with your heart, but also with your logic, with
exactly.
your brain. So, because eventually the couple will see reality, they will meet reality and see the flaws of one another. And if the only reason that they got married was because of an initial attraction, and they ignored all of the red flags, all of the incompatibilities, just because they were in love, so to speak.
Yeah, like building castle. Whenever they say, I fell in love and then we married and then we come now to divorce, I just remember that building castles in the sky. Like you have a balloon of hallucination in your mind and then reality comes and prick that balloon. Because you have to face this reality that we all are human beings and nobody is perfect. This is the very first step.
Exactly. We're going to eventually see the realities. We're going to live in reality after the honeymoon phase ends. So after that, we must have some other foundation to continue building the relationship other than that initial passion and love.
The spark.
Yes, the spark. Exactly. So for that, Islam actually, the criteria that Islam offers when looking for a partner is very logical. So it's very much based in logic. And it tells men and women to choose their husbands and wives wisely and choose people who are at the same level in different ways. So inshallah, we will have other episodes talking about what criteria we must have when choosing a spouse. But that is for another episode, inshallah.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
So firstly, we must choose our spouse wisely so that there's something to build the relationship on.
Right now we're talking about the factors. So the honeymoon phase ends. This is one of the factors, like you're facing the reality. Another factor?
Another factor is when people say, okay, so we've realized the realities, we're continuing our lives together, and then after a while, we just lose our attraction. They say, oh, we've grown apart, and we just don't have that spark anymore. Another reason for that is that the spouses don't spend enough quality time together.
I guess they do not know how, they're not skilled enough to have communication with each other.
Yes, and to maintain that attraction. Yeah. Attraction must be maintained through acts of love.
Yeah, that's the way it is.
Exactly. So that is it. Like, after they get married, the couple might just stop trying. They think that it has to go naturally, but
they,
it's something
they take
you build.
Everything for granted.
Exactly. So we must actually be actively building that love and passion throughout the relationship. And sometimes it's it might be hard work. Maybe.
Of course it is. You see, the marriage in itself is a concept that is very difficult. When I usually see people abruptly getting into marriage, I just wonder, how this quickly? How? Because, you know, you have to give a second thought to everything. So relationship is not something that you get into it, like you jump off the cliff and throw yourself into it and then live it go the way it is. Go by the currents. No, it's not like that. You have to spend time. You have to concentrate, focus. You have to give it all your heart and love and life.
Yeah, so that is it. It's hard work sometimes.
Of course.
But you have to put in the work to have a happy and long marriage. And something else that plays a role here, maybe the couple lose interest because of factors outside of their relationship.
Like, for example?
For example, as is depicted in many movies and stories.
They depict it perfectly, actually.
Yeah. We see that a lot of times marriages end because one person, maybe, starts to find attractiveness in someone outside of the marriage. So because of that, they slowly start to lose interest in their own spouse.
And which, by the way, why do you think this happens? Like, I mean, you're married, you're devoted and committed to a to an institution. Why would you go and search your happiness somewhere else?
I believe maybe it's not always the case that they actively search for it outside of the family.
So you mean unconsciously that happens?
Yes. I think that a lot of the times it happens unconsciously, and the way to prevent it, as we talked about in our previous episode, I believe, is the concept of hijab.
Lower your gaze.
Exactly. For men to lower their gaze, and women, of course.
Of course, yes.
To observe hijab for women, to prevent other men from becoming disheartened from their wives, maybe.
Yes, exactly.
To cover your beauty. And, of course, the hijab in your mannerism towards non-mahram people. So if men and women observed hijab in their behavior and do not get close and too friendly with non-mahram people, then that would prevent a connection, an emotional connection happening with someone outside of the marriage.
Yeah.
So we see
and
a lot
it
of
would
times.
Save the lives of other women.
Exactly.
Now, as Muslim ladies, we have to back each other up. Like, we have to be a
girl
help
code.
For each other. Exactly. So up until now, we talked about some factors that would lead to divorce, and unfortunately, we're running out of time. So in other episodes, we're going to cover more and more of reasons and solutions. But until now, thank you, Sister Rehane, and thank you, dear listeners. This is all for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting. Waiting for something, something to happen to me. But this waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
We are with you. What about you? Fruit Impactful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Alongside Iranians in Nowruz. In the name of God, Salam everybody, welcome to the program. Today is the first day of Nowruz holidays. Congratulations on this ancient Iranian feast. Stay with us for a special series on this occasion. We are going to introduce some of the customs and traditions of Iranians in various regions of the country on the period of Nowruz. Today we will speak about the traditions that are common almost everywhere in Iran. Hope you'll enjoy it. Many customs and traditions of world people have their roots in the past, and some of them have grown alongside man and his thoughts. An ancient tradition in Iran, with a past record of over 2,500 years, is the National Nowruz Feast. This feast enters Iranian houses with happiness every year with the arrival of spring. Nowruz has remained the ups and downs of history and lives with Iranians from any ethnicity and language. Whatever the history of Nowruz is, today it is an important nationwide feast, which is celebrated not only in Iran, but also in several countries which used to be part of ancient Iran. Nowruz is accompanied with many customs, as one of which is haftsin. Haftsin is the tablecloth which is spread in every Iranian house, and seven items are put on it, beginning with letter sin, S, in Farsi. It is a beautiful tablecloth which includes various things, each of which is said to symbolize a specific concept. These items include sib, apple, symbolizing paradise, sir, garlic, symbolizing health, samanu, pudding made with fresh wheat sprouts, symbolizing fertility and power, senjed, oil tree fruit symbolizing wisdom and calculated action. Serke, vinegar, symbolizing satisfaction. Somag, sumac, symbolizing patience, rebirth, and sunset. And sabze, fresh sprouts of wheat or other green sprouts symbolizing life and hope. Some believe that the seventh S is seke, coin, symbolizing wealth. There are usually other items in haftsin tablecloth, which include a fish bowl with fish inside, a copy of the Noble Quran, and a few colorful eggs. Many Iranians usually start the year with recitation of the Noble Quran, believing that it will bless their life for the coming year. But non-Muslims put their holy book in the tablecloth as a symbol of blessing. Another custom among Iranians before the arrival of Nowruz is khune tekuni, which means house cleaning. A few weeks before Nowruz, Iranians start cleaning their houses. They have carpets and curtains washed and walls, windows and furniture cleaned. Moreover, several weeks before the new year, municipalities in every city and town clean streets and adorn them with beautiful items. Interestingly, there is a unit in Iran's cities called Beautification Organization. This organization is in charge of decoration of streets and public furniture in every city and the peak of its activities before Nowruz. Nowruz shopping is another custom among Iranians. Iranians, based on their financial ability, buy new clothes and replace their old clothes with new ones before Nowruz. It should be reminded that while cleaning their houses, some people replace their furniture and tapestries with new ones according to their budget. AD is another beautiful custom which makes family members, especially children, happy. AD is the money given by elders to youngers upon visiting them. It is also customary to give a gift to wives by husbands. Among some ethnicities, brothers also buy gifts for sisters. AD is so significant for young children that once they do not receive it, they would think that their parents or grandparents have forgotten them. Furthermore, some friends exchange presents as a sign of affection and remembrance. Some people also give money to those who render a service, like trash collectors, janitors, mailmen, and various servicemen. Nowruz holidays end on the 13th of Farvardin month, called Sizde Bedar, or the Day of Nature. On this day, Iranians leave homes for parks, gardens, plains, and mountains to spend their time in nature. The food on this day is usually prepared in two ways. People either prepare it before going outdoors or take every item needed for the food and make it in nature. Ashreshte, a special kind of broth, is a very popular food on Sizde Bedar. Ashreshte is made with vegetables and legumes. Iranians also add whey and fried mint and onion to the food when serving it. Other kinds of ash are also made in Iran, which may contain meat, barley, and other items. Lettuce and vinegar mixed with honey or sugar are also eaten on Sizde Bedar. Dear listeners, as of the next episode, we will introduce Nowruz customs among different ethnicities in Iran.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
South Korea this week hosts the third U.S. initiative of the Summit for Democracy. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken suggested America could lead the world toward democratic ideals lacking elsewhere.
Vitalizing democracy will also require us to shape a technological future that's inclusive, that's rights-respecting, directed at driving progress in people's lives. As authoritarian and repressive regimes deploy technologies to undermine democracy and human rights, we need to ensure that technology sustains and supports democratic values and norms.
Corralled away from the venue, activists were joined by a South Korean lawmaker to question Washington's and Seoul's credibility, particularly in light of U.S. support of Israel's ongoing genocide of Palestinians in Gaza.
Since Yoon Suk-yeol came into power, our democracy index has fallen by 19 points, and we're turning into a very backward country in terms of democracy. The United States, the enabler of the massacre, Israel, the perpetrator of the massacre, and South Korea are causing the endless decline of democracy.
Activists say the U.S. and South Korea have the blood of tens of thousands of innocents on their hands. Through the provision of weapons to Israel and failure to pressure Tel Aviv to end its genocide.
It's not the time for the South Korean government or the U.S. government, who are complicit in Israel's genocide, to discuss democracy. Instead, the Korean government should urge the U.S. and Israel to immediately stop the genocide, lift the blockade of the Gaza Strip, and end Israel's colonial military occupation of Palestine.
While a rift has appeared in U.S. support of Israel, concern is mounting that the Israeli military will increase attacks on the already besieged Rafah, where Palestinians await humanitarian aid amid reports of starvation. Like here, around the world can be found supporters of a free Palestine protesting against Israel's genocide in Gaza week after week. And here at this summit titled Democracy for Future Generations, a glaring question clouds proceedings. What will happen to the next generation of Palestinians? Frank Smith, Seoul.
The people of Afghanistan are facing immense hardship and sorrow, with the country finding itself at the bottom of the World Happiness Report rankings. The report, which evaluates nations based on various factors such as freedom, health, and income, has named Afghanistan as the unhappiest, where almost everyone is very unhappy.
Everyone here agrees with the result of the World Happiness Survey. We are unhappiest, and that is because of the ongoing poverty, unemployment, and lack of freedom and opportunities. Furthermore, girls cannot receive education, which further adds to the misery of Afghan families. When women are despaired, families feel unhappy.
I have been unemployed for almost 3 years. Since then, I have not had any income. My young daughters are missing their school, and this situation is so tough. How can we be happy? The Afghan people have suffered decades of intervention and war, and they have not been happy. But experts say, under the rule of the Taliban, their circumstances have worsened.
The Afghan people have suffered decades of intervention and war, and they have not been happy. But experts say, under the rule of the Taliban, their circumstances have worsened.
As we speak, mental clinics across Kabul are receiving more patients than ever. As a psychologist, I witnessed the rise of mental health problems such as anxiety, stress, and depression. They have even led to suicide. If you take hope away from people, it will result in a depressed and dead nation. Hope is everything for human beings. If it is eroded, all progress will be lost.
The Afghan people are resilient, but the absence of basic human necessities and rights can crush even the strongest will. The international community and the ruling Taliban share a responsibility to bring some hope and light to the life of the crisis-stricken nation. Decades of foreign interventions and war have made Afghans the poorest and the saddest people on the planet. This nation has long yearned for peace and happiness, but it remains to be seen when or whether they find their lost dream. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The appointment of a new Palestinian prime minister at the current circumstances could deepen divisions as the Israeli war on Gaza rages. This is what some Palestinian factions revealed after President Mahmoud Abbas appointed Mohammed Mustafa, a long-trusted advisor on economic affairs, as prime minister and tasked him with forming a new government. Both Hamas and resistance movements, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and the Palestinian National Initiative said that without national consensus, it's a reinforcement of a policy of exclusion and the deepening of division. We met Dr. Mustafa Al-Barghouti, Secretary General of the National Initiative. He told us that the most important thing is now a unified leadership.
We're not against the new government.
we are against the way the government is being formed. We want a national consensus government, a government which is acceptable and accepted by all Palestinian political groups through a national dialogue between the different groups. And that is natural because, and for us, the main goal first before forming a government is how we structure a unified Palestinian national leadership.
Mohammed Mustafa replaces Mohammed Shtayyi, who resigned less than 3 weeks ago, citing the need for real change. Experts, however, say there had been mounting pressure on Abbas to reform the Palestinian Authority and initiate the establishment of a political framework capable of governing a future Palestinian state to take charge of all Palestinian territories after the Israeli genocidal war on Gaza ends.
First of all, that there was a pressure on Palestinian Authority to make some changes, and that's why they complied immediately and appointing Mohammed Mustafa as the new prime minister. This is on the one hand. On the other hand, which is most importantly as well, what the Palestinians wanted. The Palestinians don't want another government to be the same. The problem here is with Israel. Are they, and the international community, are they able to really make the change and let this government to work or not?
The new prime minister now would work to form a technocratic government of experts. Abbas has also asked Mustafa to create plans to reunite the administration of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, reform the government, and address internal corruption.
A real political change, not a change in words only, is what the people here desire. Moreover, the upcoming government faces numerous challenges, namely rebuilding the Gaza Strip, torpedoing Israeli plans to control the coastal enclave, and managing Palestinians' lives. Mona Kandil, Occupy Jamallah.
On Saturday, thousands of people joined a new rally in the Italian capital, organized, among the others, by the Movement of the Palestinian Students and the Association of the Palestinians in Italy. The initiative, dubbed Stop the Genocide, also saw the participation of high school students and families. People at the rally strongly condemned Italy's unwavering support to the Israeli regime.
Italy, that claims to be a democratic nation, is a country where the government goes against the people's will. Profits always come first, even when a genocide is taking place. I'm teaching my kids to never give up the fight and to never accept being submitted.
The Italian Defense Minister Guido Crosetto has recently said that Rome has continued to export arms to Israel despite assurances last year that the government was blocking such sales following Tel Aviv's invasion of the Gaza Strip. Some Italian media reports recently revealed that despite the Italian government's denials, the value of arms sales to Israel more than tripled in December 2023 compared with the same month in 2022. And December last year was the peak of Israeli bombardments on the Gaza Strip.
Western governments have been systematically supporting Zionism and Israel's criminal regime, notwithstanding the protest against Israel's crimes that have been taking place across the globe. Italy's support to Tel Aviv must stop once and for all.
La soluzione sarebbe...
A solution to the onslaught in Gaza could be found if the international community stopped militarily supporting Israel. Italy, on its side, has been actively arming Israel through companies such as Leonardo and others. If we don't make sure that the Palestinians' right to self-determination is protected, and nothing will ever change.
Earlier this week, more protests and initiatives in solidarity with the besieged Palestinians were held in several Italian cities, including Milan and Naples. Max Civili, Rome.
A growing strategic partnership between Azerbaijan and Iran in the energy sector on full display.
a collaboration that promises to bolster economic development and energy security beyond the borders of the two countries and in the region, as described by the Iranian Minister of Energy and his visiting Azerbaijani counterpart. A highlight of this cooperation is the near completion of hydroelectric power plants on the Aras River, a vital waterway on the Iran-Azerbaijan border, with construction progress reported at 96%. The strategic importance of these hydroelectric projects extends beyond national benefits, signaling a move towards greater energy independence and regional cooperation, including the creation of an energy bridge linking Azerbaijan, Iran, and Russia by connecting Iran and Russia's power grids through the Republic of Azerbaijan. This follows decisions made 2 weeks ago during the 17th Iran-Russia Joint Economic Commission in Tehran to boost economic relations in different fields. Managing shared water resources for energy production lays the groundwork for more mutually beneficial cooperation, which is why the presidents of both countries will be attending the inaugural ceremony. The projects are in the final stages, promising a significant boost in Iran-Azerbaijan bilateral relations, all in line with President Ebrahim Raisi's policy to expand relations with neighboring countries. Gizum Shahmari, Tehran.
The top annual analysis of global arms sales found that France has risen to the number two weapons exporter in the world. The gains have often been made thanks to debt from Ukraine, which has become Europe's largest arms importer. French arms sales have soared 50% in recent years and now comprise 11% of the global market. The world's leading arms dealer is still the United States, which controls a record 42% of the global weapons trade. Arms sales to Ukraine has proven to be big business, and it may explain President Emmanuel Macron's about-face on the conflict. 2 years ago, Macron warned that Russia must not be humiliated, but he's recently become one of Europe's leading anti-Russia war hawks. France's top three arms clients are India, which is the world's largest arms importer, followed by Saudi Arabia and tiny but rich Qatar. Africa is still reeling from 40 tons of illegal free arms drops France made in 2011 to support anti-Gaddafi rebels in Libya. As predicted, the weapons soon found their way to Syria, the Central African Republic, Ukraine, and elsewhere. This week, French Parliament approved a 10-year military pact with Kiev, which guarantees billions in more weapons deliveries. Russia continues to gain ground against NATO-backed Ukraine, which is an important reminder that some weapons are made to work under actual wartime conditions, and some are made mainly for sales and profit. Ramin Mazaheri, Paris.
An unprecedented global movement gaining momentum. Initiated by veteran French lawyer and academic Gilles de Verre, the Army of Lawyers for Palestine now has over 200,000 lawyers of different nationalities on board and still counting, as he travels from country to country to promote his grassroots campaign.
We are witnessing a new movement in the world. The atrocities committed in Gaza are no longer only a matter that concerns Muslim countries. Far from it. Here we have a French lawyer that has started an initiative that brought together 300 lawyers from across the world in less than 10 days, and that number grew rapidly to 100,000. And now with the MOU that we have signed at the Iran Judiciary Bar, that number will be rising to 50,000 lawyers. With Iran on board, you can also expect lawyers from Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon to join in as well.
And an optimistic Gilles de Verre, who has already filed a complaint of genocide against Israel with the International Criminal Court, demanding an arrest warrant for top Israeli politicians, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
This is going to be a tough battle, without a doubt. But in just a few months, all these lawyers have joined us. This kind of solidarity is unprecedented. We have never seen so many lawyers join hands for one purpose in history. So this is a great sign, because it won't be enough to tell a judge, look, there's no many of us. Instead, we have to be able to defend Palestine with strong legal arguments. And by the looks of things, we have a solid base for that.
His South African fellow companion shedding light on the legal aspects of the matter while explaining how the case brought to the International Court of Justice by South Africa is also paving the way.
The ICJ order specifically spoke about creating a humanitarian corridor and a humanitarian assistance to the people of Gaza. The United States and Israel were saying that the word ceasefire did not exist in the ICJ order. But this is not true because the humanitarian aid on the ground at scale cannot be delivered without an effective and immediate ceasefire.
It is very clear that we are witnessing a birth of new age. A new movement of justice-seeking people from all over the world is emerging, and that is why while the South African government files a complaint, we see a grassroots movement also taking shape, a very unique one that has brought together lawyers who are seeking justice in the battle between good and evil.
And in the words of these legal experts, this goal is not far from reach.
Lawyers believe that we live in a new era in which this new global initiative will eventually lead to justice for Palestinians. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
An annual meeting of Quran reciters and memorizers with the leader of the Islamic Revolution.
Every year on the first day of the holy month Ramadan, leader of the Islamic Revolution receives top reciters of the Holy Quran to stress the importance of this very holy book in the lives of Muslims.
In the meeting, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei described the recitation of the Quran as a sacred art, while underlining that the primary objective of this very valuable skill should be to convey the meaning and message of the Quran to the public and society and create the ground for contemplation of the Holy Scripture. Elsewhere in his speech, Ayatollah Khamenei expressed his satisfaction with the abundant number of young Quran reciters in the country, viewing their increase as a blessing of the Islamic Revolution. Meanwhile, referring to the crimes committed by the Zionist regime in Gaza, the leader pointed out that the peak of resilience that is being witnessed in Gaza presently stems from a profound familiarity with and adherence to the teachings of the Quran. Before the meeting, young and experienced reciters and memorizers were very much excited to listen and take a glimpse of the leader.
I am very much excited to recite some verses of the Holy Quran in the presence of the leader. But this is a great opportunity for me to see the leader.
This is the third time I have the honor of attending such a great event. Today I am going to have supplications to recite about the holy month of Ramadan.
Other reciters were worried about the people of Gaza who are observing the holy month of Ramadan amid the Israeli bombing and shelling campaign.
The month of Ramadan is the month of mercy and blessing. I do believe that during this month, the Zionist regime will face a big defeat.
At the end of the ceremony, the Quran reciters and memorizers held congregational prayers led by the leader of the Islamic Revolution and broke their fast together. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
March 20, 1951, members of the Iranian parliament passed a bill introduced by the country's democratically elected prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, to nationalize Iran's oil industry. The groundbreaking initiative put an end to Britain's four-decade dominion over Iran's oil industry. The Britain-owned Anglo-Iranian Oil Company enjoyed a monopolistic control over the industry and paid only a meager portion of the revenues to the Iranian government.
Nationalization was a call for independence. If you go back then, the Iranians, the entire public, realized that this move was not about economy. It was about independence. And ergo, the Mossadegh movement was very popular within. And the entire world realized that it was about gaining independence from a colonial power that controlled the economy and from, based on the economy, controlled the political spectrum within Iran.
When the then government of Mossadegh put the nationalizing of Iran's oil on its agenda in April 1951, acts of sabotage and conspiracy against the country were enhanced. The American-British coup in August 1953 against Mossadegh's government was part of the plot.
Basically, the British were plundering Iranian natural resources, and oil was at the top of the list. Iranians began to protest, and there was a growing social movement in the country to nationalize Iranian oil. When that ultimately happened, the British imposed sanctions on the country, similar to what happened after the revolution in Iran.
After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iran achieved significant milestones in the petroleum industry. These include the discovery of numerous oil and gas fields, an expansion in extractable oil and condensate reserves, a rise in oil production and extractable gas, and the discovery of new oil and gas fields. Iran was the first country in the West Asia to reclaim its oil industry. The Iranian nation's move proved to be of great importance in giving rise to the anti-colonialist tendencies all over the region and set a trend for other countries. Fateh Masumi, Tehran.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.